Tonight, Jonathan Zapp back with us, author, philosopher. I'll tell you a little bit more about him when we come back in a second as we talk about the history of the afterlife revolution and much more next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let me tell you about Jonathan Zapp. He's an author, philosopher, journalist, teacher who has written extensively on psychology and contemporary mythology. He's the author of The Zapp Oracle and is a featured correspondent and editor for Reality Sandwich, which is an online magazine. Jonathan has an extensive background in Jungian psychology, paranormal research, and dream interpretation. And for more than 30 years, he's been using the tools of Jungian psychology to study popular culture and contemporary mythology. He's back on Coast to Coast. And welcome back, John. How are you?
I'm very good, George. So glad to be back with you.
Looking forward to this. You all ready for Thanksgiving?
Absolutely.
It's going to be one of those times. What's new with you? What have you been up to?
Well, the news thing is I've been producing videos and trying to put as much of my content in a form that people could get into. And just today I released one. It's totally free. It's on skills of rabbit hole navigation. I really wanted to get it out today because it's just so appropriate to the Coast audience, because we live in a very strange time.
Yes, we do.
We are all really rabbit hole navigators. I mean, you know, every night we go to sleep, we enter another dimension where the rules of physics are different, where we are in a bizarre and idioplastic matrix, in other words, a thought-responsive matrix, which is what some people say about the afterlife realm. And that's just in the most ordinary life, because all mammals have to dream. But we live in a time where the weirdness just seems to be getting weirder every day. So I've, out of you know, my 60 years now of navigating rabbit holes, I've taken everything that I've learned about that, how not to get fooled by tricksters and how to, like, keep your moral compass and that kind of thing, and I've put it into about 5.5 hours of video. And some of it has some visual surreality, because some of it was shot at Meow Wolf in Santa Fe, which is a very surrealized environment that's sort of a thinking person's Disney World or something like that.
How do people watch it, John?
Well, it's brand new. It's been up for like an hour. So
that's it. Wow.
I don't think many people have watched it yet, but I'm hoping that they will.
The best way to get to it is how?
Well, they can just go right to my website, zapporacle.com, and they'll see that video. And then another one I did where a lot of people won't take the time to read my book on the singularity archetype, so I have a video there also that is, about 90 minutes to understand the singularity archetype with like 150 images, and so that's up there as well. It's all totally free, nothing to buy.
And we've got a lot of images and information that you gave us on the coasttocoastam.com website. Tell me about this connection between after death and other quantum evolutionary jumps. What's that tie-in?
Okay. Well, so if we start with just a little review for the audience of what quantum evolutionary leaps are, and just from mainstream biology, one of the first is something called the Precambrian explosion. This was about 544 million years ago. Some huge change happened to the life on the planet. At that time, there were three phyla of animal life. And then in just 6 million years, which was not a lot of time in that scale of the evolution of life, 538 million years ago, we had 38 phyla of animal life, the same number that we do today. So what happened to cause this explosion of biological novelty? Well, one theory is called the light switch theory, because what happened was the evolution of the eye. Now, once animals had eyes, the flow of information is vastly increased, and therefore an animal can be more aware. And so this is kind of a constant that we will see, and it relates to afterlife, is that a quantum evolutionary leap is always going to involve an advance in communication. And communication and consciousness are just almost like two sides of the same coin. So once you have eyes, then you can have predator and prey, and animals become more aware of their environment and they become more mobile and so forth. Now, flash forward to a primate, Homo sapiens, that develops an ability to think in words. And this is the, one of the greatest quantum evolutionary shifts of all time. It changed everything. It made us, even though we don't have armor or saber teeth or, things like that, it made us into by far the dominant animal on the planet. And, so wherever, again, once you can speak in words and think in words, you have an advance in communication. But you also see it, for example, in social insects. Social insects are a very large part of the biomass of the whole planet. When certain insects, like ants and bees and termites, learned to communicate in sophisticated ways amongst themselves, they came to quickly predominate. So this is also where we see the evolution of technology, and no surprise, the evolution of human beings, of course, have to parallel, because we're the source so far, unless we make AI masters that, are capable of advancing technology on their own. We are the species that is advancing technology, so of course technological evolution parallels human evolution. And so then when we developed the printing press and so forth, and now we could send our thoughts to different parts of the planet and store them in a more permanent medium. And now where we start to see what Whitley Strieber calls the afterlife revolution, where it really starts to happen is in the middle of the 19th century, where technological evolution and the birth of the spiritualism movement happened at almost exactly the same time. So in 1843, for example, just to give an historical date marker, it's proposed in front of the Congress that they fund a system of telegraphy, a telegraph system. And many people scoffed at it. There are ministers who called it black magic. And it was a very controversial thing to just fund it $30,000 to have a national telegraph system. The vote in Congress was 89-4, 80 against, and with an amazing 70 congressmen abstaining.
Wow.
Because it was so controversial.
That sure is.
So 5 years later, 5 years later, 1848, almost every major country now had a telegraph system. And in 1848, we have the birth of the spiritualism movement with the Falk sisters in upstate New York. That's where table tapping started, which seemed almost like a telegraph kind of signal, and where, the spiritualism movement just kind of exploded throughout North America and Europe. A huge revival. I mean, of course, obviously it goes back to, Aboriginal shamans communicating with the dead. But in Western civilization, there's an explosion of interest in seances and so forth. Now, of course, a great deal of it was hoaxes and charlatans and so forth. But there was also a real phenomenon happening as well. And some of the most preeminent scientists of the age, like I think it was William Crook, went around studying and used the most rigorous investigative techniques and found some genuine phenomena. And where you see these two, the birth of electronic communication with a telegraph and the beginning of the afterlife revolution, where they really converge, is in the Lincoln presidency that happens not too long after both of those telegraphy and spiritualism were both born, because in the Lincoln family, while Lincoln was president, their very beloved son, Timothy, I believe his name was, died at a very young age.
Yeah, that shocked them both.
Extremely traumatized, as any parent would be, but this was, their favorite, apparently. And so spiritualism came into the White House. Mary Todd Lincoln openly embraced mediums and had seances, apparently, at the White House. The evidence is a little bit not totally solid because, of course, they wanted to keep it private, at least to the extent that we don't know how much Abraham Lincoln himself participated in those, but we know that Mary Todd certainly did. And then, of course, we know that Abraham Lincoln had these spectacularly prophetic dreams about his own death. So really, in the Lincoln presidency, and then Lincoln was also, the New York Times called him the first wired-in president. The first Situation Room was the telegraph office, which was sort of next door to the White House. Lincoln practically lived in it during the Civil War. He would often sleep in the telegraph office. He would read incoming telegrams, whether they were addressed to him or not.
And they were coming in by Morse code, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So it sort of almost anticipates the computer age because it's sort of a binary system. And like the table tapping, which some mediums, whether you want to believe this or not, said that the table tapping method of communication, they claim, was invented on the other side by Benjamin Franklin. Now, whether that's true or apocryphal, it's just kind of interesting how these two forces would so closely parallel. And Lincoln would send very poetic telegrams to Ulysses S. Grant and so forth, because he could afford to send as many words as he wanted. So you see in the Lincoln presidency this convergence of the birth of electronic communication and a desire to communicate with the other side. Now, if you think about it biologically and on an evolutionary basis, as I pointed out, you get a quantum evolutionary shift when you're able to boost the quality of communication for an organism and a species. So, for example, evolutionary biologists will say that marsupials, like kangaroos, are very limited in terms of their evolutionary potential because they lack a brain structure that mammals have called the corpus callosum. It's a dense bundle of nerves that allows our left hemisphere to communicate with our right. Marsupials don't have that, so they don't have the potential to evolve that mammals and primates do. So if you think about, you know, that some estimates 80 billion people have died, but communication with them is very rare or episodic. The evidence of it, and we can talk about evidence for the afterlife, because some people think it's just sort of all charlatanism or nonsense.
And is there evidence of the other side, Jonathan?
Well, absolutely. There's evidence of many different kinds. I mean, the strongest, of course, is from near-death experience research. And this is another place in which technology has paralleled, because, you know, after Raymond Moody really got the field going in 1975, and even in just the last 5 years, we've had an explosion in resuscitation technology to where we can bring people back that never could have been brought back before. They say if the Titanic disaster happened now, they could scoop most of those people out of the frozen water several hours later and restart most of them.
Yep, that's true.
So we have so many more people having these profound near-death experiences, because just a few decades ago, coronary arrest, that was lights out, that was it. You didn't have a way to bring people back. And the improvement in the resuscitation techniques have grown exponentially even just in recent years. So this is another way in which, and this is one of the chief forms of evidence, is that we have people bringing back intense veridical evidence. People who had no brain function, like in the Pam Reynolds case, people who had their eyes taped shut during surgery, or like in Pam Reynolds' case, where she had clicking 150 decibel clicking earbuds in her ear to see if they could get any reaction off her brainstem. And, you know, these people are able to come back and report what people were saying, sometimes what they were thinking, able to see things from a remote point of view when their eyes were taped shut. Like in Pam Reynolds' case, she remembered exactly what the Midas Rex bone saw looked like, which didn't look like what a layman like you or I or Pam Reynolds would think it would look like, and describe all kinds of things. This evidence is so strong that, as Dr. Pim Van Lommel put it to me, we had lunch at the IANS, the International Association of Near-Death Research in Washington just a couple of months ago. He said, it is proven beyond any reasonable doubt. And this is a man of great scientific respectability. His studies of NDEs were published in the extremely conservative and respected medical journal Lancet. And he's a Dutch cardiologist. I know you've had him on a couple of times.
Yeah.
And so,
very good.
Evidence, a lot of people are just, there's sort of a cultural gap, because there's a lot of sort of pseudo-skeptic types who just don't realize how much evidence that we have now that we didn't have in the past, and again, of many different kinds. So the NDE research is the strongest, but we also have people who are able to communicate with those on the other side and who are told all kinds of highly veridical, specific information, and that you'd have to resort to some other paranormal explanation to be able to explain it away. And so, and then there's even evidence, strong evidence for reincarnation in some very well-documented cases.
Have you, Jonathan, always believed in the existence of the afterlife?
Well, no, not really. I mean, I did have my first paranormal experience when I was 2.5, really was contact with the other side. But I also had, you know, grew up in a very scientific family, so I had this fear that, you know, I was nothing but my meat body and this kind of thing. But it was having a series of spontaneous out-of-body experiences that I think was when I really got it, that I'm not in my body, and that being released from my body, I can actually feel much more alive and aware. And so it was also through doing a lot of near-death experience research. In fact, what Dr. Kenneth Ring and some other pioneering NDE researchers have found is there was a viral effect. Just researching near-death experiences has effects that parallel those of people who've actually had near-death experiences, because so much of the testimony is so convincing and has such a ring of authenticity that if you listen to enough of it, especially firsthand accounts, it actually affects you as if you've had the experience. But this also supports my research that indicates that what people experience in NDEs is contact with what I call the singularity archetype, an archetype that exists in the collective unconscious. Therefore, even if you haven't had the experience, you're able to tap into this kind of subterranean sense of the reality of this event horizon and the transformative experiences, because it exists in a field of information that we all have access to, whether we've had specific concrete experience of it ourselves.
How many people have changed their views, do you think, from non-believers to believers based on things that have been happening over the last several years? Do you think it's been a lot? Because, I mean, you can't pick up a radio, look at a television show. There's something about the afterlife somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole lot of people that have missed that stuff, but then there's also a whole lot of people who have tapped into it. And, of course, people like you and I who travel those circles, it can seem like we're surrounded by people who are aware
true,
of that, but
true.
There are also vast numbers of people who aren't. So I don't know if we have really good statistics. I mean, I know they've done Gallup polls about how many people have had contact with a deceased loved one, and that number is extremely high. I think it was between 60 and 80%. So the number of people who have really get it and are really familiar with all this new evidence, I'm sure it's probably still under 15%.
That's pretty low, I would think.
It's pretty low, but the thing is that when it comes to these quantum evolutionary changes, all you need is a sufficient minority of persons. Because when it comes to changing, like, the collective unconscious, the collective human organism, it's not one person, one psychic vote. A single person who is highly unique and highly energetic, I mean, look at Jesus, Buddha, Einstein, I mean, Jimi Hendrix, I mean, all kinds of different figures from the past who created a change wildly disproportionate to their small numbers.
Hold on, John. We're going to come back in a moment. Jonathan Zapp with us as we talk about the other side. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're with Jonathan Zapp. His book is called Crossing the Event Horizon, Human Metamorphosis and the Singularity Archetype. And his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We're talking about evidence about the afterlife. You have, I'm told, a photograph of a communication from the other side. Tell me about that, Jonathan.
Yeah, well, I mean, and I'm not claiming that it's absolute evidence, but it's definitely highly suggestive. What happened was at my dad's funeral, and he was another World War II vet like your dad,
like mine, yeah.
D-Day and all that kind of stuff. So it wasn't a tragic end. He lived to be 93. But my aunt told me this story at the funeral. It was kind of odd, even at the moment when she was telling me, because it was so specific and unexpected about my dad is a projectionist. That when, you know, in the 20s or something, or 30s, when they were children, he would had his own movie projector and would show silent films on a bed sheet in the basement, and her job was to collect the price of admission, one penny from each child.
One penny.
So I actually knew this. You know, we always had movie projectors, and I had just come across some correspondence in the house because my dad was in charge of, like, the movie projectors at the Bronx High School of Science, where he worked in the 1950s. So the next morning after the funeral, I come downstairs, and there was a very bright streak of prismatic rainbow light in the hallway, and I'm not sure where it's coming from. And then I, in astonishment, watch as it moves up onto the inside front door, and a figure of a man starts to appear in the midst of this spectrum of prismatic light. People can go on the Coast website and see the actual image that I shot with my phone on the spot. It took on more and more definite form until you can definitely see a man with a hat on and a walking stick sort of walking off into this rainbow as if he's going on a spiritual journey into another dimension. And if people follow the link that's up there, they can see how this extraordinary image was created. Sometime probably in the late 1970s, I gave my parents a little prism that my mom put in the kitchen window where it was almost completely obscured by vines. And this is a very big house, and the kitchen window is at the furthest end from the inside front door. So we're talking about, like, more than 100 feet. And somehow a beam of light and you know, they'd been in that house for 50 years, and that prism had been there for 35 years or so. Nobody, my mom was still alive, had ever seen anything like this. A beam of light just happened to hit it, and it hit it when I went back to photograph it. It looked like light coming through a movie projector lens, and then it catches a statue that was my dad's favorite statue that was at the foot of the stairs. In fact, it had a little light in it. In fact, he even, in his latter years, paid a neighbor to rewire it for him. It was so important. It said, "Don't tell Bernice, that was my mom," because he was very good at those things, and now, because of a little bit of dementia, he wasn't. That's how important it was to him. So he was really identified with it. He hit that statue and then used that statue to create this shadow in the midst of prismatic light. I mean, it was absolutely extraordinary. It was a projection. Just after, you know, I had been told this by my aunt. And so, you know, I'm not claiming that this is as strong a piece of evidence as some, but it was just so suggestive. And I have a couple of hundred other experiences like that that are as strong or stronger and that happen to me on a daily basis. They're not the best evidenced of these kind of experiences. Just because some of the cases are so incredibly strong and evidential. But so many people have had them, but there just isn't enough cultural acceptance for them to go further into the experience and to kind of, you know, not be so distracted by their phones and to, like, take some quiet time and see if somebody on the other side actually is trying to communicate to them with them and allow it to happen.
Jonathan, why, with all this great technology that we possess, haven't we been able to break that and really communicate electronically with the other side? And I'm not talking about capturing EVPs or anything, but direct communication.
Well, I know there are people working on that. I don't know how that would work and if it works and stuff. There are people right here in Boulder that I know, like Mark Macy, who work on that. And I'm just not up to date on how that would function. I know Gary Schwartz, I believe, I heard at the IONS conference, is supposed to be coming out with a device very soon. I mean, I hope that something like that is possible. What I suspect might be a catalyst that may greatly increase people's awareness of that we're not limited to our bodies is just off-the-shelf virtual reality hardware that we already have.
Mm-hmm.
The right software, I am convinced that we could create out-of-body experiences on demand in a great many people. Because if you've ever put on a VR headset, like I put on one where they simulate you're walking up to like the edge of a cliff, it's able to profoundly affect your proprioceptive sense of where your body is. So, for example, they've been using these devices on people with phantom limb pain and curing them of it. So if somebody wanted to write code for a VR headset to displace your sense of location in your own body, I think that could trigger an out-of-body experience. And then if you have enough people having that experience, I think it could really shift everything. So we really don't know where the technology, technological breakthroughs will come through. You know, it could be, I mean, Edison was trying to work.
He tried a long time ago, that's right.
Right, I mean, I do believe, and I've had experiences that strongly suggest that, that we're talking about people on the other side, they are subject to physics as well. It's just a different physics. And some of the most profound books on this subject, one that you could read for free online because it's out of copyright, is called The Unobstructed Universe by Stuart Edward White. People can find that on Project Gutenberg. Stuart Edward White was a friend of Teddy Roosevelt and a successful author of like boys' adventure stories and travel books and so forth. And his wife, Betty, was an extremely talented medium before she died. And they were doing impeccable research into spiritualism. They were kind of at the tail end of the spiritualism movement in the 30s and 40s, and were up on the latest quantum mechanics and relativistic physics and everything. It was very, very sophisticated intellectual people. And then as soon as Betty passed, and she had already had contact with a group of entities she called the Invisibles, she was able to almost immediately speak through a medium that had been known to her when she was alive, named Joan, and was immediately able to offer every kind of veridical information. When Stuart would ask Joan, and Betty speaking through Joan, information known only to the two of them, she immediately was able to give all this detailed information and information that wasn't even known to anybody present in the room. And then Betty was able to, consulting these spirits she called the Invisibles, offer a physics for the afterlife, and with the most detailed and consistent, logically consistent explanations of how time is different over there than here, and so forth. So it is not, I don't think it is out of the question at all that we could have a technology that would greatly enhance our ability to communicate with the other side, because that is how we started our talk today, is that the spiritualism movement was born with the birth of telegraphy. There may be a communications technology on the horizon that is just about to come into being that's actually going to allow that communication to happen in an on-demand kind of way, and that will be a singularity in itself. Everyone is expecting AI to be the singularity. But if we could communicate to the 80 billion people on the other side, that would be an advancement for our species of an unparalleled sort. I mean, think of all the wisdom and knowledge and technology that may exist on this other side. And there are many different accounts that make that claim. I'm trying to be cautious about what I say so sure. that I am not, insulting people who are wary and who are true skeptics.
But it is fraught with a lot of frauds, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this is part of the history of the paranormal, and it goes back to the Aboriginal times. Many shamans were very trickster-like and would use fakery. And the Fox sisters, at the birth of spiritualism, one of them, years later, said that there was a lot of what they did was fraudulent, but the other two sisters said that most of it wasn't. And my guess would be that, and this happens with a lot of people with paranormal talents, is that they have a genuine experience and genuine abilities, but then when it becomes their livelihood and the source of all their attention and so forth and identity, then they will start to fake it. But this is part of the nature of the paranormal, is that, as my friend George Hansen pointed out in his seminal book, The Trickster and the Paranormal, the trickster really governs the paranormal, the archetype of the trickster. It is anti-hierarchical that the person with paranormal access and ability could be somebody who's poor and is not connected to the elites, like the Russian peasant Rasputin, who had tremendous paranormal abilities and had a powerful effect on the family of the Tsar. So it crosses like these expected social boundaries, and therefore, according to George Hansen's theory, the more complex a social organization is, the more anti-paranormal it will be. So you have hunter-gatherer tribes, they're very, very friendly to the paranormal. They have institutionalized it with a shaman. But then you have, say, the Catholic Church, even though the religion is based on paranormal experiences, like, Jesus walking on the water and coming back to life and people talking to burning bushes and so forth. But a 1990s Catholic catechism said interest in the paranormal, talking to the dead, all this kind of stuff is profoundly anti-religious, this 1990s Catholic document says. Why should it be anti-religious? Well, the answer, I believe, is because the religion has rigidified into an institution, and it wants things to be stable. It doesn't want new miracles and new things. I kind of like turned against my own, to a certain extent, my own Reform Judaism, which was very liberal and intellectual when I went to Sunday school as a child, and they told me the age of miracles is over. And I immediately felt the falseness of this because I had already had my own miraculous experiences. And where does it say that in the Bible, that there's an expiration date on miracles?
There better not be, huh?
Right. The reason was they wanted the weird and the paranormal safely in the past. So the more complex the social order is, the more it doesn't want the disruption of the paranormal, and it becomes hostile to it. On the other hand, absolutely, as you started to say, there is a tremendous amount of charlatanism and trickery involved because these are experiences that famously cannot be produced on demand. So you have a sort of a very transgressive field, though there are many people who have, the scientific methodology in most paranormal research is much better than average paranormal research. When British biologist Rupert Sheldrake looked into it and did a kind of meta-analysis of paranormal research versus regular scientific research, the paranormal research that used at least double-blind methodology, that was like at 85%, where in regular science experiments with human subjects, it was maybe only 25%. Or Garrett Modell, that I've met a few times here in Boulder, who was a physicist and engineer at Colorado University, and I mean, he does triple-blind experiments. So you do have people who are doing extremely rigorous scientific methodology in paranormal research, but a lot of people don't know about it. It doesn't get funded. There aren't very many of them because you can lose your academic career in many cases by expressing an interest in these subjects.
Well, it's like a scientist saying that he believes in UFOs. It haunts them.
Exactly. And so just as the Catholic Church is anti-paranormal, the organization that is even more organized than the Catholic Church is science. And so you have scientism where you have an irrational antipathy to these paranormal phenomena, which are easily, there are many highly reproducible experiments that demonstrate psi effects. And yet there is an emotional agitation, an irrational prejudice and antipathy to the paranormal. I know when Rupert Sheldrake came out with his book, A New Science of Life, I think it was the editor of the journal Nature, said the book should be burned.
Jeez.
And he said that...
I thought those days were gone, huh?
He said that Sheldrake should be put down just as Galileo was, and for the same reasons. I mean, it was amazing he would say this because he was speaking as if he were the Pope, castigating Galileo, who, of course, turned out to be right.
He was right. That's right.
So you have this intense, irrational antipathy in the pseudo-skeptical movement. And I say pseudo-skeptical because they don't even know the meaning of the word. The skeptics were Greek philosophers who believed that their powers of thinking and observation Skeptis is just a Greek word that means to investigate. They believed that their ability to investigate was improved by not reaching conclusions. So you'll have a pseudo-skeptic say, oh, I'm a skeptic about near-death experience. I think it's just an oxygen-starved brain. This is the opposite of skepticism, as Dr. Raymond Moody has pointed out, because you start with a conclusion based on no research, because the oxygen-starved brain idea is easily disconfirmed, and you don't do any actual investigation. So most people who call themselves skeptics are actually the opposite of skeptics.
Do you think that there's going to be a day, Jonathan, when we just bust loose and get this done and it's easy to communicate with the other side?
Well, I think it's extremely possible. I mean, individually we will, because individually all of us will cross the event horizon ourselves. But I think it is quite possible because, you know, people have definitely would not be on the side of those who want to limit the human race. And where there is a great human will to do something, it seems to happen. And we have a tremendous desire to be able to communicate to people on the other side. Many people have suffered tragic losses. A lot of the most profound recent books about communication have been about parents who've lost children, because that is such a traumatizing thing.
Oh, it sure is. John, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We'll chat more about your work, and we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.